Courtney, it's such a pleasure to be talking with you about Suddenly Last Summer. I wanted to start by asking you a question generally about your work. As a composer, you work across so many genres and styles of music. And for people who are new to your work, how do you describe it to people who, for instance, are your greatest influences and musical forebears?
Sure. Usually my shorthand for describing my music is that I will, mention I'm influenced by a lot of different styles of music, that I'm also interested a lot in things that are interdisciplinary. There are certain themes that are throughout, I mean, if I had a slightly longer explanation, I would say there are certain themes that are throughout all of my music, which is one of them is usually spirituality. So that's a theme that's that I would say is throughout my body of work since I was younger. But there's also other themes that I've found have become a thread in my work over time. Some of those are thinking about like history, often African American history, and more recently I would say African diasporic history. I'm also influenced by my city, by New Orleans, growing up in New Orleans. So a lot of things that have to do with New Orleans as a place, or like histories of New Orleans, are influenced. And another thread is sometimes social, I would say in general, social awareness and social justice. So those are some themes in my work as well. And usually there's that connection between the social awareness, mental wellness, and spirituality somewhere along the way. So that's kind of my inspirations. But as far as musical inspirations, they are very, very wide. But I can tell you some of my earliest inspirations. So the earliest memories I have was playing was my the music in my church where I grew up, St. Luke's Episcopal Church in New Orleans. So I have these sounds of like the organ. And sometimes we'd have the West African drumming on special occasions. Usually there'd be an Anglican hymn, but someone's playing a tambourine with like some sort of Caribbean rhythm. And then we did like spirituals as part of the music. So all of that soundscape working together are like my first music memories. I also grew up in New Orleans, so there's all the music you hear just in the city. That's a part of my soundscape. So the idea of like brass bands or just music being a part of everything. And the first composers who I fell in love with their music was the first one was Scott Joplin, and then the next one was Frédéric Chopin. So between the two of them, like I always, and you know my love for Scott Joplin, but between the two of them, I always carry their music around. Like if I'm traveling somewhere and I want to have some music to play, it's usually those two because they're the first two composers I learned about and loved. And then over time, I've just learned so much. Like I know that at some point Wayne Shorter became a big influence, John Coltrane, later Alice Coltrane, Jerry Allen. So a lot in the jazz world, a lot in the classical world. I've also grown up, especially later after growing up, later playing through different churches, I got very into gospel music.
And when did you first start to have an idea that you might be a composer?
That was pretty early. So, ever since I was playing piano, like I was kind of playing on the piano at 4, and I had to wait to start piano lessons. Both of my older sisters played, and so I knew that there was this thing where we could take lessons, and I couldn't wait. So I started at 5, and ever since I've been taking lessons, I was writing music. And I think one person who helped me think about it, I didn't have the word composer yet, but my kindergarten teacher actually showed me how to write some notes. Like I remember holding the pencil like that. But she was like, she thought it was important that I would learn like how to actually write down ideas, because I would stay, she had a piano in the classroom, which I think is amazing thinking about it. But she had a piano in the classroom, and she would include that as part of like at some point of the day in kindergarten she would play. And I showed her at some point that I was making up my own music. So I remember a few times my mother brought me to her house. Her name was Miss Bonnie Fastring. She showed me about writing down notes, but I kind of had an intro to it. And then later I had a teacher, Miss Dean Curtis. That was in 4th grade. I took talented music in the public schools. And she used to play, she would teach me piano, so I learned like my rudimentary, like my scales and arpeggios. There's usually a piece I was working on. So I remember working on Scott Joplin and Chopin, and I'm sure others, and Bach at some point. I got into that. And then she'd always make space for me to bring whatever I was into. I really love Mariah Carey. And that's back when you used to go to the music store and get like the piano like transcriptions. So I'd always have some book of like transcriptions, usually Mariah Carey, but sometimes it was something else. And then there would be a space she'd leave for me to show whatever I wrote that week. So usually I wrote something that week and I'd share it. So she made space for all of that. And then she's the one who told me at some point to use the word composer. And that's what I was doing. And it made me feel it was something to take serious. Also, my parents made a point of making sure I recorded the works I was doing, because I would memorize them, and for years I remembered them, but they made sure that I was recording them and keeping a record, which sadly to say, after Hurricane Katrina, all of that went away, but I did have this like collection of works that were recorded for many years.
So improvisation has always been an important core of the way that you compose.
Yeah, improvisation has always been, it's always been that combination. Like it would be something that I came home from learning in piano, which would be something very simple, just kind of like those early exercises you learn. But I would take something like that and then I would improvise on that and create something new. But the something that I created that was new would be something I would memorize. It would be through compose. And then that would be like the set composition, and I would just remember it and play it the same way each time. But yeah, the way I would get to it was through improvisation. And then I started to, over time, the way I taught myself to write was through that, like what I was learning in piano classes, but also like listening to the radio and TV and movies and trying to learn how to play by ear. So I was learning how to read at the same time and learning how to train my ear to learn things that I heard on the radio. And so I would do the same process, like learn a little something, and then I would improvise on that for a while and then come up with like a fixed piece.
And then you studied improvisation more formally with George Lewis, is that right?
I did, yeah. So I would say all along the way, like I started studying more about that in when I was going into high school, because I'd always been studying classical piano most of my early, like ever since I started, I continued on with classical music. But I was always improvising as well. And then I started studying improvisation in a way, like when I went to this jazz camp, Louis Satchmo Armstrong Summer Jazz Camp in New Orleans. And then that led to me going to the Arts High School, New Orleans Center for the Creative Arts. And then I focused, I was there in the jazz area. And so I would say that's when I had like a focus on learning improvisation along with others and everything. But yeah, eventually I did get to work with George Lewis at Columbia, which was another very pivotal moment in my development and really helped me focus in on this career as a composer.
What did you learn from George?
A lot of things. I mean, there's a lot of things I learned musically, and then there's other things I learned just like kind of as a person or like personal development. But I would say that musically, I was just exposed to a lot. Like being at Columbia in general, of course, that includes your class. It was just like throwing myself in different situations where it was like just kind of being introduced to a lot of ideas at one time. That's what I remember that first year. It was like overwhelming in a good way. It got harder the second year, I think. But yeah, I was introduced to a lot. So it was both by like the people I was studying with, and then also the people I was studying, alongside. So just being around all these composers who came from very different. There was a wide range of trainings and also interests and also countries people were coming from. And I think that I just kind of like, I was exposed to a lot. So I think with George, it was like really helping. One thing he was helping me to do was to not be so over, like to take in everything, but not to lose myself in the process. So when I say it's like learning music, it's also like the personal side. It was always kind of reminding me, like, here's what you have to offer. Like, there's a lot to learn, but also these are the things that you, like, don't lose yourself in the process and build upon what it is that you want to do. And that took many years to kind of understand what that was. But some of it was very technical. Like really just the technical side of getting my ideas on the paper. 'Cause I would say when I came to Columbia, I'd been writing for years and I'd been playing for years. And I think at the time I was kind of like more focused on performing than composing, at least career-wise. I was getting gigs and I was performing and then I would write on my own time. But the music I was creating at the piano was one sound, and then what I was writing was like an approximation of it, but not quite. And so I was trying to like get those things closer together. So a lot of what my doctorate was some technical things of really just getting into the craft of the composition in such a detailed way, more than I had done in the past. Being introduced to like different concepts and of acoustic and electronic music. So even though I don't do electronic music as a focus, it was such a big part of what I was around. So just being exposed to a lot. And getting that technique down, but then the other side was that whole thing of kind of recognizing what it was inside of me that was most important to me while taking in all these different perspectives.
When you've talked with me about the process of composing, particularly on Suddenly Last Summer, you sometimes say you hear something or you haven't heard something yet. And I'm fascinated by what happens at the creative moment. What is that for you? How does that function? Is it a felt sense? Are you literally hearing something? What is composition for you?
Yeah, it works different at different times because there's sometimes where things do like start off from a flow. So things are flowing and I might actually hear like certain harmonies or I hear a melody. And other times if it's not flowing yet where I can just imagine it how it sounds in time yet, it might be me coming up with different tools. Like I'll think of, okay, here's some different harmonies that I want to try out, or maybe sometimes it starts from a rhythm, or sometimes it starts from like a number. And like in this piece, it was interesting because with Suddenly Last Summer, with different characters, I think I created differently. Like with Miss Venable, this was more so at first when it was a sung part. I was thinking musically a certain way for Miss Venable. And then even when it wasn't a sung part anymore, I had these ideas that were just very strict. So I was thinking like there's this Miss Venable theme that's like 12, it's like a 12 tone theme. And there's not much else 12 tone in the music, but there is this theme for her that's 12 tone, and I kind of associated that with like that time of music and like certain kind of structure in the music. And then also the number 5 is throughout the piece because the whole thing about the 5 o'clock cocktail. And so since 5 o'clock and how important that was in the story that she always had to have things at a certain time and she had to be in control. So whenever that theme, it sounds like a bell or a clock, and it's always in the meter of five. So
So interesting, because you've also talked about the number five in other works of yours
that's true
as,
for different reasons.
right, as a spiritual number.
That's true. Yeah, I thought, yeah, I read somewhere that five is like the number of life. So I've used five in a way, thinking actually the opposite of what Mrs. Venable. So I don't know, but I've used it like my own. Like if it's like free association, I have different meanings for numbers. But I think in this case, it was like, okay, in the play, this is something that comes up a lot. So it was like 5 o'clock was important. And so in that way, it was more just me responding to what was said in the play. Just like with birds, it was like certain things that are mentioned a lot. It's like, okay, well, where does that come in? So there's a lot with her 5 o'clock theme. So yeah, it is borrowing from things I've done in other pieces, but it's like it's in a meter of five. The harmonies are also five notes and they're built in intervals of fifths. So each of those chords, like they're all intervals of fifths, but they're kind of like different variations of it. Like sometimes they're a perfect fit that could be diminished, augmented, but I was just kind of playing around with these harmonies and then I picked an order that I thought worked well.
And even though Mrs. Venable is not singing in the production, do we still hear her 12-tone theme?
Yeah, so there's parts and it'll come in, it'll be like a time where she's entering the scene or getting ready to do something, and then like there's one part, I forget which scene, but it's like the flute plays her theme. So there's a time where it's the flute playing her theme kind of freely behind when she's talking, and then we'll get to hear it for the first time together when everybody's in the room. So it's just written in the music that is very rubato, very open tempo, and the flutist knows that already. It's kind of like this is happening behind the scene. So she's playing her theme, and there's another time Miss Venable enters, and it's the viola and the cello. They play her theme. One of them plays her theme in order, and the other one plays it in the exact reverse. But they're just kind of playing it together. So it's just kind of like more subliminal that this is like a Miss Venable theme.
Motif. You've written often in the past for voices, but suddenly last summer is the first time you've really written for something theatrical for the stage in this kind of hybrid opera drama. What excited you about the idea of the project when we first talked about it, and why did you agree to take it on?
I think there were two main reasons. I'm not sure which one was in the foreground. One reason was the actual collaborators. So I was excited about getting to collaborate with you like directly, like because we've been working together. So I've had you as my professor, and then there's been like you doing the producing side. And then I was like, when you said, okay, we collaborate artistically, I just thought that was exciting. So that was a big part. And I had been to Oklahoma, and so I was really excited getting to see that live on Broadway and learn about Daniel Fish through that. So I think part of it was like the actual collaborators and thinking, oh, okay, that'll be interesting. And I felt like it'll be a chance to do something. I felt like there'd be some things about this project that would be different than some other projects I've done based on that. And then also the story also had something different than I feel like I'm familiar with Tennessee Williams, but I'm not like a Tennessee Williams person in the way like I know Tennessee Williams, like there's like a cult of the Tennessee Williams people are not cult, that sounds negative.
Well,
There's
particularly New Orleans.
in New Orleans, it's very strong. And actually my mama was on the board of the Tennessee Williams Festival growing up. So I remember always hearing about it. Like I knew it's just a thing. Like every year there's a Tennessee Williams Festival, it's a big deal. There's so many Tennessee Williams things like named after him, and so he's an important figure in New Orleans, of course, as well as America and I guess the world. But I thought it was, so I was familiar with him, but not familiar to the point where it wasn't going to be like a whole discovery. Like I felt like I was, in order to learn about this piece, I just started kind of learning more about Tennessee Williams and outside of Streetcar Named Desire, because that's the piece that I felt very familiar with. But I was like, okay, let me. In addition to suddenly, said last summer, I was like watching the other movie versions of his pieces, and then reading about him. I got a chance to see a play of Cat in a Tin Roof, locally in New Orleans. Last year, and just taking in Tennessee Williams as an idea. But to answer your question about excitement, I like that it was a story about New Orleans, but it was a different New Orleans than the one I grew up in. So it's a very specific part of New Orleans, like to think of like Garden District and to think of like a wealthy white family in the 1950s, right? But yeah, in the 1950s, it's like I kind of know from outside who that would be, but it's not like the New Orleans that I grew up in or that the New Orleans that I usually draw from inspiration. And so I thought, as a person who's like my city is such a big part of everything, my music, but also like the work I'm doing now outside of that, I thought it would be a nice project, thinking about New Orleans stories. So there was a lot with it. The other thing was I was conflicted with some things with the story. And I was trying to resolve it, and I was also trying to figure out, because whenever you take a project, especially of this size, it means you'll spend a lot of time with it. And so going in, I was like, is this a story I want to spend a lot of time with some of the things that I was kind of like dealing with the characters or the story. But I noticed that the project kept coming back to my mind, and so it was like when I say I hear stuff musically, it's also like when there's inspiration for something, I feel like if I put it down and it keeps coming back to me, then it probably means like it's a project for me.
And how do you feel now about those aspects of the play that gave you pause at the beginning?
They're still not resolved. Like, I have, it was very awkward in the first workshop to actually see the boys singing this part.
The choir.
The choir. Yeah, like I was excited artistically because I was excited artistically because their voices sound so amazing, and then I was also just impressed. I was like, you know, how good they are and everything. But then I think with the storyline, it's just uncomfortable things about like the main character Sebastian taking advantage of boys. And it's just kind of not, you know, it's not one of those like stories where you decide who's like the good guy or the bad guy. And, which is, you know, I guess that's what makes the work so rich, but it's also like some, I remember I was trying to figure out who I was feeling like sympathy. I mean, with the main character Sebastian, I just didn't know like what kind of feelings to have towards him as a character. But I think it also is like the humanness of the whole thing. Like there was, we don't, first of all, we never get to hear from him, so it's hard to really have a judgment of him that would be fair, but we hear about him from different perspectives, and some of those perspectives make you feel sympathy, and others make you feel like he was like did really horrible things. So yeah, so I think those things are unresolved, but I think working on it as an artistic project has felt, I don't know, it just made it like a discovery together. And I think I'm always affected by whatever's happening around at the times because, like, I was thinking of things a certain way when we started. And I think with a lot of hearing about all these wealthy people abusing young people these days, and it keeps taking on different tones. But then that's like a piece that, like I feel like a good story can evolve with times and have different meanings and different contexts, and that's kind of how I feel about it right now. But I feel like one thing I was looking forward to, like I mentioned about doing different things, I felt like the way that Tennessee Williams writes and the sort of emotions that he gets to would really push me musically to do some things that are different than I've done before, and I do feel like that happened in the process.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about that because, of course, in opera and music theatre, music is really a vector for psychology and thought. And I wondered how you'd approach that because it's, of course, there's always psychology and thought in your work, but it's not in the past necessarily been serving a dramatic end. And I wondered how you'd approach that in Suddenly Last Summer and whether it change things for you.
Yeah, it's hard for me to reflect on it that way yet, 'cause I am curious how it's changed things, but I do remember in the process there were certain parts I felt most ready to start with, and others came later. And I think the parts that I was drawn to starting with, where I was like, this is like clearly like a song moment. And the very first one I wrote was actually the scene one. No, it comes to scene four. But anyway, the first one I wrote was the song about the Dueling Oaks. So I remember it was and I tried something kind of different. I've been doing stuff in recent years. It's like where I just try to see where my hands land on the piano when I'm creating. For many years, I was like composing away from the piano, especially if I'm doing like if piano's not part of the project. But well, and I guess in this case, it ended up, it made sense to keep it in the project. But at first I didn't know what, you know, if that would be part of the instrumentation. But usually for a while I was working away from the piano so that I could just kind of hear the instruments and think about things a different way. But recently I've been returning to just having these times where I put on a voice memo and I kind of see where my hands land. Like I might have something in mind, either like an emotion or a story plot or something, and just kind of like let it go for a while. So I was doing that with this piece before I think I sat down and wrote the first piece. I remember I can't remember where I was because I feel like I was moving around a lot. But I remember I was doing some program in Oberlin, and I was there for an extended time. It was like a residency, not an artist residency, but a university residency. So I was doing that for a week, and I had time in a practice room, and I would just try to think of like some emotion. I didn't know where it would land in the piece, but I was just coming up with these different voice memos, and that's where a lot of my early ideas were, and a lot of them were kind of vamp-like. So like what ends up being like the last piece of the opera was one of those early improvs at the piano where I kept repeating these themes. And then the one with the Dueling Oaks, I just remember when I got into that one, just trying out different chords and recording them, and then I built around that. But where am I going? I forgot.
Oh, that's great. You
Okay.
really answered the question. I want to go back to New Orleans for a
Okay.
second, which is, of course, where you're from and where you live and work. And as you say, it's where Suddenly Last Summer is set. And I wondered if there are particular ways that New Orleans influences you musically as an artist, and also whether the play's location in the Garden District influenced the ways that you approached it musically.
So the general thing with New Orleans, I think is there's definitely certain styles of music I associate with New Orleans. I think about it, or just the idea, not just styles like genre, but how much music is a part of everything, like hearing it on the street. And I would say in this play, there's a part where it takes place in the fictional town in I mean it takes place in Cabeza de Lobo, but it sounds like it could be a parade in New Orleans, so it's like a combination. So I remember thinking about how and Tennessee Williams was so descriptive about the sound. So I was picturing like the tin cans and things that were like cymbals. And then there was the movie version. So I was thinking about the Hollywood version. And then, but I was also thinking like, oh yeah, on I mean, there's brass bands, but there's also other. I thought less of brass bands. There's like the flame carriers in a parade. There's all these things that you just see like at street parades. Or like the tap dancing, there's all kind of things that you hear on the street. Well, that's more in the French quarters. I was thinking about all of those things along with him describing the music, because I was like, I could hear the tin, I could hear that in all these in the New Orleans style, and what he was describing. But I think on a general level, when I think about New Orleans, there's a lot of like connecting with ancestral memories and also like just kind of being in several time periods at one time. That's one main, like I would say, general larger picture thing I think about that the influence from New Orleans has in my music. Like I don't feel this whole like past, present, future difference. It's like, especially certain areas, like you go and you just feel you're in several time periods. So it was interesting getting to go into that house that we all went together.
Can you tell me what that house is?
Yeah, so the house on Louisiana Avenue that was so the artist Horton Humble lives there now and watches over the house. It was the house of the Boltman family who owned the fun they owned a funeral home that was like a major funeral home of New Orleans that was right on that corner. And then that house was right behind there. So that's where the Boltman family was, and then that was the house where Tennessee Williams stayed at one point and wrote portions of this story. So when we visit and actually see the indoor garden, it was just like it brought a whole other thing to life. So that was like a time to kind of like be, especially the way Horton, who lives there now, makes a point to keep things as much as they were as possible. Like he cleans up the plants, but he doesn't make them all neat and a different style. He like it keeps him kind of wild, but also but just tries to like keep it like it was. And he explained how the place had been bigger, so some of the stuff that's now like a parking lot I think was a continuation of the house at one time. So I think getting to like for someone as haunting as Tennessee Williams, I think it really helped to be in different spaces, like have the experiential things. So like being in that space was a big part. And I was listening. Another thing about Garden District, or just being uptown, because I live uptown as well, a little further away from that area, but When it came to listening to birds, I was thinking about birds that I would actually hear in my own backyard. So since birds are a big part of the piece, I included some other birds as well, but I just wanted to start with like, what birds do you actually hear in Uptown New Orleans? And then I was looking at what birds do you hear in the Mediterranean. It turns out it all kind of equals out, like it's not so different. But I wanted to think about things that way where it wasn't just kind of abstractly thinking about birds. It was like, okay, I hear red cardinals all the time. I hear the yellow warbler, and I hear the crows all the time. Crows are all around. We have a lot of crows in New Orleans. So anyway, there's a lot of ways I thought about New Orleans, but there were certain scenes like when he talked about Esplanade Avenue and then going to City Park and me actually going to see the Dueling Oaks. Like there's a sculpture someone made that kind of marks like, oh, this is one of the areas that would have been like called the Dueling Oaks. I didn't really have like a lot of feelings from it, but I like to visit it. It's just kind of like makes it very real. Like, okay, if I imagine City Park and don't imagine this is where the New Orleans, where the museum is, but imagine like an earlier time where people would go and have duels and stuff. So that Roosevelt Hotel, I used to live across from the Roosevelt Hotel when I first moved home. So when they talk about the ball in the Roosevelt Hotel, I'm like, oh yeah, I would always walk through there, and that's where I would have like meet with folks. But that's one of those buildings where you really feel you're kind of aware that place was always there. It had different names at different times, but it was like the gathering place. There's so much history in that one building, actually. Even dealing with race riots, and there's a lot with that building, but like every building that he mentioned specifically or location had its own histories, and so that was something as someone who grew up in a place, I would think about like my former relationship with those places, but then think about it through the eyes of this play.
You have also mentioned the university residency you had at Oberlin, and then you've written the score for Suddenly Last Summer in various places. And I get the sense that where you are has quite an influence on what you're writing. Is that right? And can you tell us about some of the places that you wrote the score in and what whether they correspond to particular parts of the opera.
Yeah, that was something that was new for me, so I couldn't be like, oh yeah, this is how I work. It was like, this is how I work on this particular project, and it was important, and water is a big part of that. So I mentioned Oberlin because I remember it was probably at home. I came up with some ideas, I'm sure, but between home and like wherever I was moving around, I had a piano. I was like, I didn't know really where to really start with the piece, but there were certain like main emotions about it. So I had these voice memos of different ideas, and I just kept them as like, and I named them different words or something, or even just track one, two. And then I felt like I need to go somewhere. I felt like I needed to be, well, first of all, I needed a residency. So I do rely on artist residencies to get a lot done, because a lot of times I can get a lot done in a week somewhere at a residency that might take me 3 or 4 months at home, especially while teaching and everything. But this time I was like, okay, I didn't have time to plan something. And usually I associate upstate New York with like being my thinking place. And then I was like, what about something nearby where I could just drive there? And so I decided to go to Gulfport, Mississippi. Biloxi, Mississippi is usually a destination, like if you're gonna go somewhere, because that's where they have like most of the people go to the beaches and they have all the casinos and stuff. And so I was like, I didn't want to be where it was like a busy area, but I wanted something close. I also wanted something that was close where I felt like I could be comfortable too, because certain parts of Louisiana I would go to. So I was like, so Gulfport was like a good destination. I knew that they had beaches, and I had a friend from there who told me like, here's some good places to stay. So, and then I was glad that Bard also was able to help support with that. I was gonna go either way. I was like, I need to go somewhere. But I'm glad Bard was able to help. So I had 2 weekends where I went to Gulfport. I listened to all these voice memos I had made earlier, like months earlier, and I walked around in the water, and ideas started. I walked around in the beach water, and ideas started coming to me like, this theme really fits this character, or this, I can see this fitting like Catherine, and she's singing about this and singing about that. And then I would go and start making my initial like notated ideas. And I think Gulfport is when I wrote down themes themselves. So I was like, I had this like chart of themes. So I had like the 12-tone theme for Miss Venable. I had certain themes for Catherine. I didn't have themes for the doctor, which ended up being okay, but I had some that were very specific, like this is for this character, and then I had other themes that were just like this emotion, that emotion, and I made a chart. So that was my trips to Biloxi, I mean to Gulfport, Mississippi, and walking in the water really made things just come together. I don't know, it just kind of balanced everything. The challenge with water is that I feel like sometimes you could get deeper into something than you want to, like spiritually. I feel like there is something else going on. So on one side it was like, oh, this is very somehow being in the, and then I didn't think about it ahead of time with Tennessee Williams actually being from Mississippi. Because I guess we claim him in New Orleans, but I was also like, oh yeah, he's from Mississippi. And I was drawn to go to Mississippi. I didn't really think about it that way at first. But yeah, there's something about water where I feel like it can kind of spiritually connect you in a way that I feel like it's good to be careful about when doing a project. Like, I feel like, and I talked about this with someone else I know who's very spiritual, and she was saying, oh yeah, water, like that's kind of deep. Like you can kind of really get connected. And it depends on what you're getting connected to, like how you might feel afterwards. So one part of my process with this project was to do these deep dives where I kind of really connected both in nature and just kind of shut, like kind of entering Tennessee Williams' world. And then I'd have to step away for a certain amount of time. So that was like part of the process. I couldn't really stay in the mindset of like, because the first piece I wrote was Dueling Oaks. And it was like, after I just kind of got into it musically, and I'm like, it should build here, it should do these things. And then afterwards, I was like, I just wrote a piece about sexual violence. And I had to kind of like think about it for a moment. I was like, oh, I think this is a good time to step away and kind of do some other things. So, like, a lot of this piece has been like the deep dive and then step away from it. So anyway, that's Gulfport. But later when you connected me with Camargo Foundation, it was perfect because first of all, I did need a residency, but also I'd never been to the Mediterranean. So like the only way I could picture it is just kind of like, pictures or like movies. And so it really made a difference to be in that space. And certain things just really came to life because I was like, was he here? Like I was like, he might have been directly at Cassis. I don't know. Because it just felt like it was perfect. But I'm sure other cities maybe are similar. But like things that he would describe on the beach, like he would say, like on this side was a restaurant at the harbor or something. And I was sitting at the beach in Cassis and looking to the right, seeing a restaurant, and then I see a harbor, and all the people around the beach, and like yeah. So that was a part of my process while I was there. I mean, I enjoyed the residency part, like getting to meet folks, but a lot of it was just like spending time at the water. I went to the main beach a few times. But there was also the smaller beach on the other side where I would just kind of walk around in the water. I did the same kind of thing where I had recordings, like new voice memo music recordings, and I would just kind of walk around the water and listen to it, and then I could go back to the room and start writing things. And that music was very different than the music I wrote in Mississippi.
What was which parts of the score did you write at the Mediterranean?
A lot of like It was a lot of the scenes where it wasn't like a big song moment, like where she's but they're still important moments, but they weren't like the like I'm gonna like it wasn't like the ending of the play where it was like she was really like singing these like last summer or one fine one. So I remember I can't think of the words though, but there's parts where I write it, a lot of things are like kind of flowy. Like they're kind of like a 9/8, 6/8, but they're like these harmonies that kind of shift and move in different ways. They're not like the kind of vamp ones where like there's a regular vamp and she sings a melody over it. It's like, yeah, it's like a lot of just flowing and moving harmonies. And I was doing some different kind of, some reason I just came up with some different harmonies there. They were a little more extended and very water-like. And also another thing from Cassis was hearing the church bell every hour. So I think I didn't know that that was good. I kind of knew water. I was like, okay, Mediterranean water. Also just kind of like hearing people, just being around and hearing people talk and socialize and stuff, like getting that whole environment. But the part I didn't plan was like the church bells every hour. And so that ended up becoming a big part of the piece.
You have already mentioned that as a composer, you're very connected to musical history of various kinds, various histories. Are there particular references in the score of Suddenly Last Summer to other works, other composers that we should listen out for?
There's the choral moment. I don't know if I thought of it this way till it was described in a rehearsal, but we're like, oh, that's the Billy Strayhorn moment. So like I did think of it in a way of, I did picture it kind of like that time period, but I wasn't like thinking like directly like I'm gonna do a Billy Strayhorn thing here. But there's like these moments with the boy chorus where they sing in a on oohs and ahs, and it's kind of has a Billy Strayhorn and Duke Ellington sound there, but it's like a haunted context. It'll be behind, the doctor talking or different things, and then it's part of the choral feature as well. I think other influences, I'm sure there's all kind. I think like with those, with some of the music, oh, I know, I was playing through certain music a lot when I was in at Camargo. I was playing, so I have a quote in there from Purcell, the Dido and Aeneas, when I am laid to rest. Some reason during that time, like that was like the piece I was always playing, and it seemed to fit the vibe. But I wasn't like planning, oh, I'm gonna quote it. But I think once I got to orchestrating, then I was like, it just felt like, oh, at this moment I had like a quotation of that, and then it departs from it pretty soon. And then I also had some influence from Berg's Vosek in the towards the end when he's singing about, once he's killed his wife and he's singing about blood, and the orchestration is doing this thing where it keeps rising and he walks off into the water. So there was a moment in the play, it was like, it's only a few measures, so it's not like, it kind of happens quickly, but it's like quotes of that. But otherwise, I think a lot of Wayne Shorter. I'm very influenced by Wayne Shorter with how I think about harmony. And I like that Michaela Bennett caught that. She was like, she could hear a lot of the Wayne Shorter influence. So I was like, yeah, it's a big influence. And I like that full circle moment because the first time I heard her perform was her premiering a piece by Wayne Shorter with the LA Phil, and I was on the same program. They performed a piece of mine, and I met her, but I didn't put it together until after we were working on the project that that was the same singer that.
That's
So
amazing.
yeah, so there's a Wayne Shorter thing, and she caught that. So yeah, there's so many influences, but I think opera-wise, I was listening to a lot. There's some moments I would say go back more to like romantic operas that I love, and like Verdi and Puccini. And so some of these like classic sounds that I was thinking of, but also a lot, I think a lot with Baroque. I think there's Monteverdi. I really like Monteverdi opera style. And I found like, even as I was listening, I didn't really think about some of the runs. Some of the runs may have had more of a, in one context could be more R&B, but in another context sounds more Baroque. So it's like, I'm not like thinking about styles. I'm kind of doing these techniques, but when I hear it back, I'm like, oh, this sounds Baroque where I would have thought it would have had another. I don't think there's any real R&B in necessarily, but anyway, I'm just saying like there's all these influences that popped out once I hear it.
I love this sense of creativity being always in relation to influences, circumstances. I mean, the way that you're talking about the score as responding not only to Tennessee Williams, but to the city of New Orleans and these other places where you wrote, and then also the way that musical influences pass through you and refract and echo. Because sometimes, I think we can be trained to think about creative people as geniuses, meaning everything just comes to them, fully formed and in isolation from anything else. But actually, what you're describing is so much more interesting than that because it's a constant tapestry of, what you've heard, what you love, where you are. what you're thinking. And that's so profoundly the way that we experience the world as humans.
I like that tapestry.
You mentioned Michaela Bennett, and you very early on we knew that Michaela was going to play Catherine Holley. And how is it to compose for her? I mean, it would be very different if you were composing and didn't know who was going to play Catherine, but you're collaborating very, very deeply with Michaela. Tell me about her and what this creative relationship is like.
Yeah, I mean, it is nice that from the very beginning, before we got started, we had Michaela in mind, and it gave me time to really like listen to a lot of her material that I found online, and just kind of get an idea of her voice, but also kind of the range of pieces that she's been a part of. And it was good that it was time, like there was time to just do like checking out her material and learning her voice without the pressure of creating quite yet. So that by the time I was thinking about melodies, I was hearing her voice with it. And I was both wanting to write directly for her and then also think like, okay, if this is a soprano part, the technical things like here's what is for a soprano and also here's what's for particularly for Michaela. And I felt like it helped having that first workshop too. We had the New Orleans workshop with Joelle Dyson. And there's certain things about them that are similar and certain things that are different. Everybody has a unique voice. But I think like working with Joelle, who I've worked with a lot, it was nice to get to try out ideas that like if they're in this part of the voice, they have this sort of effect, just the different ranges, the different styles that are possible or approaches. And thinking about hearing it with Joelle and then also thinking about Michaela's voice at the same time and imagining. So anyway, there all of that was happening with the creating. But I think once I actually had the first drafts and Michaela was part of it, I learned a lot, from her directly. Like before we got into the space together, I could talk with her in detail about it, like technically different things. Like, yeah, if I sing the syllable on this note, here's the effect it'll have. Or also like just her let me know the things that did work, which I was glad to know a lot did work. But then there were other things where she's like, but I can also if I do this in this range, or if I do, just kind of knowing what was possible. And then once hearing the first pieces with her, I think writing the second wave of music later, I already had like a, by then I actually had a working relationship with her directly. It wasn't only like, here's her voice and the stuff she's done. And more abstractly, it was like, okay, I've seen her in rehearsal. I know she's a great improviser. So I was like, oh, I learned that. So I think just working in rehearsal and hearing her try out things different ways and suggest things helped when I created new material for the piece to already have some of those ideas in mind and what really falls well in her voice.
And what is her voice like? What is she like as
Mean,
a musician, singer?
she's amazing. I mean, just the skill level alone is like amazing. Like when she like it's like anything that's written she can do, which I mean that's a under it's just like she basically she has a lot of skills. She has a lot of her own personal sound, to her voice. And then I think I was just amazed with like when she hits those very high notes, like how strong and how many times she could do it. I mean, just me as a non-vocalist, because I love writing for voice, but I'm not a vocalist, so I can't really picture doing. I'm just like in awe a lot of times, I think, of like the skill. And I think the other part of working with her is in addition to, I like the different inflections she'll bring depending on what it is. Sometimes it has more of a, sometimes it's more operatic, sometimes it's more new music-y. I never know what to call new music, but because everything's new music, but new music-y or music theater. So like, kind of how she'll go between those things in a way that's very organic and what's needed in the moment is one thing. But I think also, because we've had rehearsals, I got to see the other side about like the acting and just the expressions of when once things are in story mode. And that's like another, like, it's good I was able to focus on the part that I do, which is the writing for her voice. But I think I just got a whole appreciation of how that fits in with the overall, with her acting and really coming to life as this character.
So in the score, as you've said, Catherine and a boys' chorus sing, and the other characters are speaking. And that's, of course, an idea that emerged collaboratively from our work together and with Daniel Fish. And I wonder if you can now reflect on the relationship between speaking and singing, which is providing a whole other kind of palette. For the piece.
Yeah, I mean, I'll definitely say it's an adventure. Like, it's an adventure, and I think it's one of those things about working collaboratively. Like, I might envision, like, originally the piece, when it was fully sung, I was envisioning ways to create contrast between characters by the singing style, the musical, maybe like for different voice types. So, like, maybe you have a soprano, you have a mezzo soprano, or you could have a contralto for Miss Venable. So I was thinking about those sort of things, and then how to, some of the things that remain, like how there could be certain things from Miss Venable that are very different than Catherine's kind of more free-flowing singing. But I think once it's acting, you just, some things are very technical with this process. Composing music, knowing that there's acting, and knowing that the acted, the spoken words happen on a different time scale than the singing. So trying to create a flow in the music overall while keeping those kind of technical things in mind, like writing music that's flexible enough, excuse me, flexible enough in those moments where it's like, okay, all this acting's happening here. It can happen anywhere between, the timing's flexible, but the timing isn't, ex but the timing is still spoken timing versus singing timing. So I'm just thinking about timing of ideas I have and what to write that can work artistically and also work on a practical level where it's flexible enough, it doesn't feel like it's pausing, where it feels organic. And so that's like a lot of, it's like a lot of guess on math going going on. I mean, these are like the later steps, thankfully. Like, I feel like it helped to ha have like a lot of the real like singing moments like mapped out already. And then have like other singing moments that are, I know are happening with acting, and having heard it in person during that workshop, I kind of have an idea of flow, but it's always sort of a guess, and I have to write in a way that's not too, like, sometimes when I write a piece, I am very like, I know the timing of it. So it's like, this is gonna happen. It's at this tempo. There's some variation if it like slows down a little bit, but pretty much this happens and this goes to that, and this builds a certain way musically. And so I think knowing that I want to have it flexible enough for not only that there is text happening, but knowing that the text happening can change also. And so because editing is such a big part of the project, I want to write music that will work. I know I'm working this out as we're talking. I wanted to create music on this later stage of it that I knew would connect things in a way that could be flexible enough, but still was purposeful musically.
And do you, so Catherine essentially starts singing right at the very beginning of the piece and continues singing right until the end. Are you, in some ways, conceptually thinking of it as one long aria?
Well, I think in response to the prompt, yes. Because I think that when we talked about it, talking with you and Daniel, I think it was like understanding if the voice, the idea that she would be less coherent in the beginning with what she's saying, at least word-wise, like the words are so long. And so that was, I remember Daniel had that recommendation about when lasting a very long time. So I had the notes written, and it was kind of like, what do you call it? It was rubato, But it was like, what if you maximize that? And so I think, like, knowing, I think once that was the prompt that we all discussed together, that she would start off that way and that it would be the ending when she really like tells her story. Then I was thinking how to build kind of like, it's like kind of like a slope communication wise from this to that, where at the end she's just like saying it. But I knew that it wouldn't be like a clear slope. It would have to have these moments, you know, in between. And plus it's a lot of text. So it's like trying to think of how to like switch up the music to match the different types of text. And it's, I think because the text, the way y'all did the libretto, where things are in one scene and then they come back in another scene, that helped to like connect. I was like, oh yeah, the music, it just made it clear where music ideas could return, but return in different ways. And that was kind of fun to play with, because like, if okay, it's the same words here, same words there. I want to do something similar musically, but make it a little different. So sometimes I'll have something similar, but something orchestration-wise will reverse. Like instead of the things fading out this way, they fade up or something. Or like sometimes I would have something where like musically, okay, the text repeats, but let me reverse this or try this thing a different way. So yeah, a lot of that was built into how the libretto went, where it was like these ideas repeat, and that her knowing that Catherine, over the course of an hour, goes from background to, I mean, goes, not background. Yeah, she becomes more and more coherent to like the end when she really delivers like the dramatic aria.
But she lets rip.
Yeah.
Courtney, you mentioned that we first met each other in a course at Columbia on collaboration. And collaboration is, of course, central to everything that you do as an artist. And this project has a particular kind of collaboration and so on. But how do you think of collaboration as almost as a spiritual practice?
That's
Is
a
it
good question.
about a balance between, I mean, I wonder what it's like, because in a way you do spend so much of your time by yourself when you compose. And then there are these moments in this, but probably in every project, where suddenly there are all of these other people involved, and your ideas by necessity continue to evolve and shift. And so there's a certain amount of flexibility required and letting go required in that, which must be exciting and painful at the same time.
Yeah,
So,
it's a balance. I mean, I'm sure it's spiritual in some ways, but I do see it all, every time there's a collaboration, it's really like a social, like it's really like an interesting study of social dynamics. And for me, like, I mean, it's like outside social dynamics, like looking, if I were to look in, but I think for me personally, like, I think that balance of, sometimes it's hard to let go of ideas, but sometimes I can be very easy on that side, and then I have to know when to say, oh, I can't let go of this idea, you know? So I think it's like the, it's always like a push and pull of communicating ideas together and trying to like, trying to understand the vision, you know, of each other. Because if there's one person who has the vision, it's like, okay, here it is, and then you know, you kind of state the vision, and everybody kind of knows what their part is. But when you're truly collaborating, you're trying to each, you know, you want to be on the same page with that so that you can free flow in your own part of it, but understand what the vision is. And I think a lot, that's the part that just takes a lot more conversation and also a lot of times just actually trying it out. Because it's like, you know, it's like, I think this is what we're going for, and we try it. And so I think, yeah, for me, it's like collaboration is always a social experiment and a communication, maybe more that a communication experiment. Because it's like, what are the best ways to communicate with one another to get the best result and for everybody to feel like the part that they're contributing is at the max of what they would contribute and like feels good to them, but also works for the project. So I'm always fascinated with it. I feel like collaboration is never actually like easy. So sometimes when it's funny because I'm so like drawn to it. Like I'm like collaboration, collaboration. I get so excited. But then each time I collaborate, I'm like, oh, it's hard work. But then I feel like there's a sense of accomplishment that comes when a collaboration works out well. Because then you're like, wow, like we went on this journey together, and it's like, there were like you could think about the times that felt certain and the times that felt uncertain, but then when you create something that works, and especially if everybody could be happy with it, I mean, that's just like the best feeling.
And it leads you that journey to a place that you couldn't have imagined at the beginning. Just a couple more questions. One of the things that we love doing at the Fisher Center, and I love doing, is exploring at the intersection of different forms. And, at first we were talking about our collaboration as an opera. And now it's not exactly an opera, and it's existing somewhere in the world of opera and drama and theatre and even spoken word as well. And that I find enormously satisfying. And I wondered whether you are always interested in breaking down categories and definitions in your work, and whether that becomes a particularly fertile testing ground for you.
I would say sometimes. So like I think it's a sometimes thing. Like I think in some of my work, I like taking traditional forms and doing the form like not for musically being traditional, but I would like another time to do an opera that's fully sung. And that's something that would be a nice, it's like its own challenge to work on. And then this is its own challenge to do something that's sung and acting. It's like everything comes with its own like musical thing. But I would love to do an opera that's fully sung to see what that's like to have all the characters and their different themes and like I like some traditional forms. Like one of the pieces I want to do in coming years is possibly like an oratorio. So I like thinking like, okay, oratorio. I want to use some of the traditional things of that. Like it has the I think orchestra, chorus, and soloist, vocal soloist. But what I do musically with that can be very open and creative. But I might want to stick with that traditional structure. But I also find it, creatively rich to do the other thing where it's like, okay, we have this thing that we're calling an opera, and now it's an opera slash drama or opera play, and it works in a different way. So it's like you're living in two worlds. It's just like another kind of, like it might not be been what I had in mind at first, but then when we got into it, it became its own like you have to be open. It's like, oh, okay, we're doing this other thing. I haven't experienced that before, and so it's just like, well, given that, how would I think orchestrationally or something, like details of orchestration when I know there's like a lot of speaking at this moment and maybe less singing or just the themes, the kind of themes are like anyway, so my answer is that I don't think I'm particularly invested in in having like a genre and seeing how I can deconstruct it. I guess I'm less deconstructing in a lot of my work, but I do think that it's nice to not feel locked into preconceived ideas of what something is at the same time.
Suddenly Last Summer is, as you know, the first of a series of projects that we're going to be working on that in some way explore the subject of hope. And I just wondered what hope means for you.
I mean, hope can mean a lot of things. I think hope is like a lot of times hope I think comes up when you're in a situation that could seem hopeless. So I think that's the time where we focus on hope is when it's like when there really is a question about if it's possible, like is there hope? And that's when hope is very possible. I mean, that's when it's very powerful because it's not an easy, it's not, it's like the word faith. It's like faith, meaning like evidence of things unseen, or whatever that Bible verse is. But I like that definition of it, it's evidence of things not yet seen, because it wouldn't be faith if it was like an easy, like, oh, I know, like if you have certainty already. So I see hope in that way, where there's not the guarantee of everything working out, but if you have hope, it makes it possible. And so it's interesting, like with this story, that it seems like a lot of the hope is in the character of Catherine speaking, even with everything that could happen to her. She could have easily done what was asked of her by her aunt and silenced herself, and then not have to be at risk of a lobotomy or whatever else would be seen to like silence her, you know. And even an earlier part of the story where she fought the guy who raped her, she could have just not told anybody and gone along to get along, but she went and fought him, and people thought she was crazy. But she seemed like someone who was like, I don't know if hope is the word there, but she was someone who was like willing to fight for what was the truth. And I guess that idea of fighting for truth is like an element of hope. And I don't know, that's what we focused on as a story, and why when you and Daniel were talking about the storytelling, the idea of changing the original play order to make sure that Catherine was there from the beginning and it's throughout the whole play and she's a central focus. But yeah, I think that's what I would say with hope. And I think musically with hope, I always have that element because I do often deal with kind of difficult themes or topics or emotions. And usually there's something in the music that, like, I feel like it's like going into the sorrow of a situation or the difficulty or the pain of a situation, but always having some element of hope with the music in some way. And that can happen in a number of technical ways, but I think more just intention of when I'm writing, I have to feel a certain element of hope, and I try to have that in the music.
That's so beautiful. Courtney, thank you very, very much
Thank
for
you,
talking to me.
Gideon. I know, I was like, what did I leave out? I can't remember. But anyway, I
Is
still
there
have to
any, is
see.
there anything else you'd like to say?
I'm trying to remember, because I know we're talking about the places. We talked about Biloxi, New Orleans. There. Oh, yeah, and I guess being in Brooklyn was a big part of it. So I'd add the importance of being in Brooklyn during this
Tell me
process.
about that.
I think even though that was more workshop side, and less like I went there to write, but the Brooklyn side was very important just for. Just thinking about our time in Brooklyn, everybody kind of being, well, besides me, I was coming from New Orleans, but everybody being kind of near home. But I think a certain, like, to have that time was key, and the spacing out of the workshops. I just thought, I was like, how else would this have come together in this way? Which is, I'm sure that's why you do it that way. But it was like nice for me to experience that, just like the kind of process of it. Like, I think just how often, because someone was telling me in some places, like, in Europe, or I don't know, someone was telling me that's not always the case where you get so many workshops along the way.
I think when we're inventing something new, we have to do it this way. I mean, it would be different if, I think also if it were less collaborative and it really were you just delivering a complete score, you know, that process might be very different. But we really have been figuring out how to tell this story, to do it musically and to do it now. And that has to be a long, I mean, the cooking of that, I think, has to be long and slow so that you can work and then we can hear, and then you can, as you say, step away from it because it's also so intense, as you already talked about. I mean, this is like kryptonite, the material in this play, and you don't necessarily want to be completely immersed in it for too long.
Yeah, it's like, what if you don't come back?
What
That's
if
what I
you
kept
don't
thinking.
come back?
I felt that way. I was like, okay, don't like come back from the life. Yeah.